advantage of the free cold air. Either way, as I look at him, I have a flashback to last night, to the whistling of the air as the clubs came down like scythes, and I feel a rush of hatred for him, for all of them. I fantasize about pushing the old guy inside the freezers and bolting the door over his head. Thinking about the raids makes me anxious about Hannah again. News of the raids is in all the papers. Apparently, hundreds of people all over Portland were taken last night to be interrogated or summarily shipped off to the Crips, though I didn't hear anyone reference the party in the Highlands specifically. I tell myself if Hannah hasn't called me back by this evening, I'll go to her house. I tell myself that in the meantime, there's no point in worrying. But all the same, the guilty feeling keeps worming around in my stomach. The old guy is still hovering over the freezer compartments and paying me absolutely no attention. Good. I slip on the apron again, and then, after checking to see that Jed isn't watching, reach up and grab all the bottles of ibuprofen, about a dozen of them, and slide them into the apron pocket. Then I sigh loudly. Jed, I need you to cover for me again. He looks up with those watery blue eyes. Blink, blink.
I'm reshelving.
Well, we're totally out of painkillers back here. Didn't you notice? He stares at me for several long seconds. I keep my hands clasped tightly behind my back. Otherwise, I'm sure their trembling would give me away. Finally, he shakes his head. I'm gonna see if I can dig some up in the supply room. Grab the register, okay? I slip out from behind the counter slowly so I don't rattle, keeping my body angled slightly away from him. Hopefully he won't notice the bulge in my apron. This is one symptom of the delirium no one ever tells you about. Apparently, the disease turns you into a world-class liar. I slip around a teetering pile of sagging cardboard boxes stacked at the back of the store and shoulder my way into the supply room, shutting the door behind me. Unfortunately, it doesn't lock, so I drag a crate of applesauce in front of the door, just in case Jed decides to come investigate when my search for the ibuprofen takes longer than usual. A moment later, there's a quiet tap on the door that leads out into the alley. Tap, 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 tap. The door feels heavier than usual. It takes all my strength just to yank it open. I said to knock 4 times, I'm saying, as the sun cuts into the room, temporarily dazzling me. And then the words dry up in my throat and I nearly choke. Hey, Hannah says. She's standing in the alley, shifting from foot to foot, looking pale and worried. I was hoping you'd be here. For a second, I can't even answer her. I'm overwhelmed with relief. Hannah is here, intact, whole, fine, and at the same time, anxiety starts drumming through me. I scan the alley quickly. No sign of Alex. Maybe he saw Hannah and got scared off. Hannah wrinkles her forehead. Are you gonna let me in or what? Oh, sorry, yeah, come in. She scoots past me and I shoot one last look up and down the alley before closing the door behind me. I'm happy to see Hannah, but nervous too. If Alex shows up while she's here. But he won't, I tell myself. He must have seen her. He must know it's not safe to come now. Not that I'm worried that Hannah would tell on me, but still. After all the lectures I gave her about safety and being reckless, I wouldn't blame her for wanting to bust me. Hot in here, Hannah says, lifting her shirt away from her back. She's wearing a white, billowy shirt and loose-fitting jeans with a thin gold belt that picks up the color of her hair. But she looks worried and tired and thin. As she turns a circle, checking out the storeroom, I notice tiny scratches crisscrossing the backs of her arms. Remember when I used to come and hang out with you here and bring magazines and that stupid old radio I used to have and you'd steal chips and soda from the cooler? I finish. Yeah, I remember. That's how we got through summers in middle school when I first started logging time at the store. I used to fabricate reasons to come back here all the time, and Hannah would show up at some point in the early afternoon and knock on the door 5 times, really soft. 5 times. I should have known. I got your message this morning, Hannah says, turning toward me. Her eyes look even bigger than usual. Maybe it's that the rest of her face looks smaller, drawn inward somehow. I walked by and didn't see you at the register, so I figured I'd come around this way. I wasn't in the mood to deal with your uncle. He's not here today. I'm beginning to relax. Alex would have been here already if he was planning on coming. It's just me and Jed. I'm not sure if Hannah hears me. She's chewing on her thumbnail, a nervous habit I thought she'd kicked years ago, and staring down at the floor like it's the most fascinating bit of linoleum she's ever seen. Hannah, I say, are you okay? An enormous shudder goes through her all at once, and her shoulders cave forward and she starts to sob. I've seen Hannah cry only twice in my life. Once when someone pegged her directly in the stomach during dodgeball in second grade, and once last year after we saw a diseased girl getting wrestled to the street by police in front of the labs, and they accidentally cracked her head so hard against the pavement, we heard it all the way up where we were standing, 200 feet away. And for a moment, I'm totally frozen and unsure of what to do. She doesn't bring her hands to her face or try to wipe her tears or anything. She just stands there, shaking so hard, I'm worried she'll fall over, her hands clenched at her sides. I reach out and skim her shoulder with one hand. Shh, Hannah, it's okay. She jerks away from me. It's not okay. She draws a long, shaky breath and starts speaking in a rush. You were right, Lena. You were right about everything. Last night it was horrible. There was a raid. The party got broken up. Oh, God, there were people screaming and dogs. Lena, there was blood. They were beating people, just cracking them over the head with their nightsticks like nothing. People were dropping right and left, and it was... Lena, it was so awful. So awful. Hannah wraps her arms around her stomach and doubles forward like she's about to be sick. She starts to say something else, but the rest of her words get lost. Huge, shuddering sobs run through her whole body. I step forward and wrap her in a hug. For a second, she tenses up. It's very rare for us to hug, since it has always been discouraged. But then she relaxes and presses her face into my shoulder and lets herself cry. It's kind of awkward, since she's so much taller than I am. She has to hunch over. It would be funny if it weren't so awful. Shh, I say. Shh, it's gonna be okay. But the words seem stupid, even as I say them. I think of holding Grace in my arms and rocking her to sleep, saying the same thing as she screamed silently into my pillow. It's gonna be okay. Words that mean nothing, really, just sounds, intoned into vastness and darkness, little scrabbling attempts to latch onto something when we're falling. Hannah says something else I don't understand. Her face is mashed into my shoulder blade and her words are garbled. And then the knocking begins. Four soft but deliberate knocks, one right after the other. Hannah and I step away from each other immediately. She draws an arm across her face, leaving a slick of tears from wrist to elbow. What's that? She says. Her voice is trembling. What? My first thought is to pretend I haven't heard anything and pray to God that Alex goes away. Knock, knock, knock. Pause. Knock. Again. That! Irritation creeps into Hannah's voice. I guess I should be happy she's not crying anymore. The knocking? She narrows her eyes, staring at me suspiciously. I thought nobody comes in this way. They don't. Sometimes, the delivery guys? I'm stumbling over my words, praying for Alex to go away, grasping for a lie that isn't coming. So much for my newfound skills. Then Alex pokes his head in the door and calls out, Lena? He catches sight of Hannah first and freezes, half in and half out of the alley. For a minute, nobody speaks. Hannah's mouth literally falls open. She whips around from Alex to me and then back to Alex so quickly it looks like her head is going to fly off her neck. Alex doesn't know what to do either. He just stands completely still like he can go invisible if he doesn't move. And it's the stupidest thing in the world, but all I can blurt out is, you're late! Hannah and Alex both speak at once. You told him to meet you? She says as he says, I got stopped by patrol, had to show my cards. Hannah gets businesslike all at once. This is why I admire her. One second she's sobbing hysterically, the next second she's completely in control. "Come inside," she says, "and shut the door." He does. Then he stands there awkwardly, shuffling his feet. His hair is sticking up all weirdly, and in that second, he looks so young and cute and nervous, I have a crazy urge to walk right up to him in front of Hannah and kiss him. But she quashes that urge really quickly. She turns to me and folds her arms and gives me a look I swear she stole from Mrs. McIntosh, the principal of St. Anne's. "Lena Ella Halloway Tittle," she says. "You have some explaining to do."
"Your middle name is Ella?" Alex blurts.
Hannah and I both shoot him a death stare, and he takes a step backward and ducks his head. Words still aren't coming very easily.
"Hannah, you remember Alex?"
She keeps her arms locked in place and narrows her eyes. "Oh, I remember Alex. What I don't remember is why Alex is here."
He was going to drop off.
I'm still searching for a convincing explanation, but as usual, my brain picks that second to conveniently die on me. I look at Alex helplessly. He gives a minute shrug of his shoulders, and for a moment, we just stare at each other. I'm still not used to seeing him, to being around him, and again, I have the sensation of falling into his eyes. But this time, it's not dizzying. It's the opposite. Grounding, like he's whispering to me wordlessly, saying he's there and he's with me and we're fine.
"Tell her," he says.
Hannah leans up against the shelves, stocked with toilet paper and canned beans, relaxing her arms just enough so I know she isn't mad, and gives me a look like, "You better tell me." So I do. I'm not sure how long we have until Jed gets tired of manning the register by himself, so I try to keep it short. I tell her about running into Alex at Roaring Brook Farms. I tell her about swimming out to the buoys with him at East End Beach, and what he told me when we were there. I choke a little bit on the word invalid, and Hannah's eyes widen. Just for a second, I see a look of alarm flash across her face, but she keeps it together pretty well. I finish by telling her about last night, and going to find her to warn her about the raids and the dog and how Alex saved me. When I describe hiding out in the shed, I get nervous again. I don't tell her about the kissing, but I can't help but think about it. But Hannah is open-mouthed again at that point, and obviously in shock, so I don't think she notices. The only thing she says at the end of my story is, "So you were there? You were there last night?" Her voice is weird and trembly, and I'm worried she's going to start crying again. At the same time, I feel a tremendous rush of relief. She's not going to freak out about Alex, or be mad that I didn't tell her. I nod. She shakes her head, staring at me like she's never seen me before.
"I can't believe that. I can't believe you snuck out during a raid for me."
"Yeah, well," I shift uncomfortably. It feels like I've been talking for ages, and Hannah and Alex have both been staring at me the whole time. My cheeks are flaming hot. Just then, there's a sharp knock on the door that opens to the store, and Jed calls out,
"Lena, are you in there?"
I gesture frantically to Alex. Hannah shoves him behind the door just as Jed starts pushing at it from the other side. He manages to get the door open only a few inches before it collides with the crate of applesauce. In those few inches of space, I can see one of Jed's eyes blinking at me disapprovingly.
"What are you doing in there?"
Hannah pops her head around the door and waves. "Hi, Jed," she says cheerfully, once again switching effortlessly into cheerful public mode. "I just came by to give Lena something, and we started gossiping."
"We have customers," Jed says sullenly.
"I'll be out in a second," I say, trying to match Hannah's tone. The fact that Jed and Alex are separated by only a few inches of plywood is terrifying. Jed grunts and retreats, closing the door again. Hannah, Alex, and I look at one another in silence. All three of us exhale at the same time, a collective sigh of relief. When Alex speaks again, he keeps his voice to a whisper.
"I brought some things for your leg,"
he says. He takes the backpack off and sets it on the ground, then starts pulling out peroxide, bacitracin, bandages, adhesive tape, cotton balls. He kneels in front of me.
"Can I?"
he says.
I roll up my jeans and he starts unwinding the strips of t-shirt. I can't believe Hannah is standing there watching a boy, an invalid, touch my skin. I know she would never in a million years have expected it, and I look away, embarrassed and proud at the same time. Hannah inhales sharply once the makeshift bandages come off my leg. Without meaning to, I've been squeezing my eyes shut. "Damn, Lena," she says. "That dog got you good."
"She'll be fine," Alex says,
and the quiet confidence in his voice makes warmth spread through my whole body. I crack open an eye and sneak a look at the back of my calf. My stomach does a flop. It looks like an enormous chunk has been torn out of my leg. A few square inches of skin are just plain missing.
"Maybe you should go to the hospital," Hannah says doubtfully.
"And tell them what?" Alex uncaps the tube of peroxide and begins wetting cotton balls.
"That she got hurt during a raid on an underground party?"
Hannah doesn't answer. She knows I can't actually go to the doctor. I'd be strapped down in the labs or thrown in the crypts before I could finish giving my name. "It doesn't hurt that bad," I say, which is a lie. Hannah again gives me that look like we've never met before, and I realize that she's actually, and possibly for the first time in our lives, impressed with me. In awe of me, even. Alex dabs on a thick coat of antibacterial cream and then starts wrestling with the gauze and the adhesive tape. I don't have to ask where he got so many supplies. Another benefit to having security access in the labs, I assume. Hannah drops to her knees. "You're doing it wrong," she says, and it's a relief to hear her normal bossy tone. I almost laugh. "My cousin's a nurse. Let me." She practically elbows him out of the way. Alex shuffles over and raises his hands in surrender.
"Yes, ma'am," he says and then winks at me.
Then I do start laughing. Fits of giggling overtake me, and I have to clamp my hands over my mouth to keep from shrieking and gasping and totally blowing our cover. For a second, Hannah and Alex just stare at me, amazed, but then they look at each other and start grinning stupidly. I know we're all thinking the same thing. It's crazy, it's stupid, it's dangerous. But somehow, standing in the sweltering storeroom surrounded by boxes of mac and cheese and canned beets and baby powder, the three of us have become a team. It's us against them, three against countless thousands. But for some reason, and even though it's absurd, at that moment, I feel pretty damn good about our odds. Chapter 16. Unhappiness is bondage, therefore happiness is freedom. The way to find happiness is through the cure. Therefore, it is only through the cure that one finds freedom. From Will It Hurt? Common Questions and Answers About the Procedure, 9th Edition, Association of American Scientists, Official USA Government Agency Pamphlet. After that, I find a way to see Alex almost every day, even on days I have to work at the store. Sometimes Hannah comes along with us. We spend a lot of time at Back Cove, mostly in the evenings after everyone has left. Since Alex is on the books as cured, it's not technically illegal for us to spend time together. But if anyone knew how much time we spent together, or saw us laughing and dunking and having water fights or racing down by the marshes, they'd definitely get suspicious. So when we walk through the city, we're careful to stand apart, Hannah and I on one sidewalk, Alex on the other. Plus, we look for the emptiest streets, the rundown parks, the abandoned houses, places where we won't be seen. We return to the houses in Deering Highlands. I finally understand how Alex knew how to find the tool shed during the raid night, and how he navigated the halls so perfectly in the pitch dark. For years, he has spent a few nights a month squatting in the abandoned houses. He likes to take a break from the noise and the bustle of Portland. He doesn't say so, but I know squatting must remind him of the wilds. One house in particular becomes our favorite. 37 Brooks Street, an old colonial that used to be home to a family of sympathizers. Like many of the other houses in Deering Highlands, the property has been boarded up and fenced off ever since the great rout that emptied the area. But Alex shows us a way to sneak in through a loosened plank covering one of the first floor windows. It's strange. Even though the place has been looted, some of the bigger furniture and the books are still there. And if it weren't for the smoke stains creeping up the walls and ceilings, you might expect the owners to come home any moment. The first time we go, Hannah walks ahead of us, calling, "Hello! Hello!" into the darkened rooms. I shiver in the sudden dark and coolness. After the blinding sunshine outside, it comes as a shock. Alex pulls me closer to him. I'm finally getting used to letting him touch me, and I don't flinch or whip around to look over my shoulder every time he leans in for a kiss.
"Wanna dance?"
he teases. "Come on," I slap him away. Feels weird to talk loudly in such a quiet place. Hannah's voice rolls back to us, sounding distant, and I wonder how big the house is, how many rooms there are, all covered in the same thick layer of dust, all draped in shadow.
"I'm serious," he says.
He spreads his arms.
"It's the perfect place for it."
We're standing in the middle of what must once have been a beautiful living room. It's enormous, bigger than the whole ground floor of Carol and William's apartment. The ceiling stretches up into darkness, and a gigantic chandelier hangs above us, winking dully in the limited shafts of light that sneak through the boarded-up windows. If you listen hard, you can hear mice moving quietly in the walls. But somehow it's not gross or frightening. Somehow it's kind of nice, and it makes me think of woods and endless cycles of growth and death and regrowth. Like what we're really hearing is the house folding down around us, centimeter by centimeter.
"There's no music," I say.
He shrugs, winks, holds out his hand.
"Music is overrated," he says.
I let him draw me toward him, so we're standing chest to chest. He's so much taller than I am, my head barely reaches his shoulder, and I can feel his heart drumming through his chest, and it gives us all the rhythm we need. The best part of 37 Brooks is the garden in the back. An enormous overgrown lawn winds between ancient trees, so thick and gnarled and knotted their arms twist overhead and form a canopy. The sunlight filters through the trees and spots the grass a pale white. The whole garden feels as cool and quiet as the library at school. Alex brings a blanket and leaves it inside the house. Whenever we come, we take it and shake it out on the grass, and all three of us lie there, sometimes for hours, talking and laughing about nothing in particular. Sometimes Hannah or Alex buys some food for a picnic, and one time I managed to swipe 3 cans of soda and a whole carton of candy bars from my uncle's store, and we get totally crazy on a sugar high and play games like we did when we were little, hide and seek and tag and leapfrog. Some of the tree trunks are as wide as 4 garbage pails mashed together, and I take a picture of Hannah, laughing, trying to fit her arms around one of them. Alex says the trees must have been here for hundreds of years, which makes Hannah and me go silent. That means they were here before. Before the borders were shut down, before the walls were put up, before the disease was driven into the wilds. When he says it, something aches in my throat. I wish I could know what it was like then. Most of the time, though, Alex and I spend time alone, and Hannah covers for us. After weeks and weeks of not seeing her at all, suddenly I'm going to Hannah's every single day, and sometimes twice in one day, when I see Alex and then when I actually see Hannah. Fortunately, my aunt doesn't pry. I think she assumes we had a fight and are making up for lost time now, which is kind of true anyway, and suits me fine. I'm happier than I can ever remember being. I'm happier than I can ever remember even dreaming of being. And when I tell Hannah I can never in a million years repay her for covering for me, she just crooks her mouth into a smile and says, "You've already repaid me." I'm not sure what she means by that, but I'm just glad to have her back on my side. When Alex and I are alone, we don't do much, just sit and talk. But still, time seems to shrivel away, fast as paper catching on fire. 1 minute it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The next minute, I swear the light is draining from the sky and it's almost curfew. Alex tells me stories about his life, about his aunt and uncle and some of the work they do, although he's still pretty vague about what the sympathizers and the invalids are aiming for and how they're working to achieve it. That's okay, I'm not sure I want to know. When he mentions the need for resistance, there's a tightness to his voice and anger coiling underneath his words.
At those times, and only for a few seconds, I'm still afraid of him. Still hear the word invalid drumming in my ear. But mostly Alex tells me normal stuff about his aunt's Frito pie and how whenever they get together, his uncle gets a little too tipsy and tells the same stories about the past over and over. They're both cured, and when I ask him whether they aren't happier now, he shrugs and says they miss the pain too. This seems incredible to me, and he looks at me out of the corner of his eye and says, "That's when you really lose people, you know, when the pain passes." Mostly, though, he talks about the wild and the people who live there, and I lay my head on his chest and close my eyes and dream of it. Of a woman everyone calls Crazy Caitlin, who makes enormous wind chimes out of scrap metal and crushed soda cans. Of Grandpa Jones, who must be at least 90 but still hikes through the woods every day, foraging for berries and wild animals to eat. Of campfires outside and sleeping under the stars and staying up late to sing and talk and eat, while the night sky goes smudgy with smoke. I know that he still goes back there sometimes, and I know he still considers it his real home. He nearly says as much when I tell him one time that I'm sorry I can't go home with him to check out his studio on Forsyth Street, where he has lived since starting at the university. If any of his neighbors saw me going into the building with him, we'd be finished. But he corrects me really quickly. That's not home. He admits that he and the other invalids have found a way to get in and out of the wilds, but when I press him for details, he clams up. "Someday, maybe you'll see," is all he says, and I'm equal parts terrified and thrilled. I ask him about my uncle, who escaped before he could stand trial, and Alex frowns and shakes his head. "Hardly anybody goes by a real name in the wilds," he says, shrugging. "He doesn't sound familiar, though." But he explains that there are thousands and thousands of settlements all around the country. My uncle could have gone anywhere, north or south or west. At least we know he didn't go east. He would have ended up in the ocean. Alex tells me that there are at least as many square miles of wilderness in the USA as there are recognized cities. This is so incredible to me that for a while I can't believe it. And when I tell Hannah, she can't believe it either. Alex is a good listener, too, and can stay silent for hours while I tell him about growing up in Carol's house and how everybody thinks Grace can't speak and only I know the truth. He laughs out loud when I describe Jenny and her pinched look and old lady face and habit of looking down her nose at me like I'm the 9-year-old. I feel comfortable talking about my mother with him, too, and how it used to be when she was alive and it was just the three of us, me, her, and Rachel. I tell him about the sock hops and the way my mom used to sing us lullabies, even though I can only remember a few snatches of the songs. Maybe it's the way he listens so quietly and stares at me steadily with his eyes, bright and warm, and never judges me. One time I even tell him about the last thing my mom ever said to me, and he just sits and rubs my back when suddenly I feel like I'm about to cry. The feeling passes. The warmth of his hands draws it out of me. And, of course, we kiss. We kiss so much that when we're not kissing, it feels weird, like I get used to breathing through his lips and into his mouth. Slowly, as we get more comfortable, I start to explore other parts of his body, too. The delicate structure of his ribs under his skin, his chest and shoulders like chiseled stone, the soft curls of pale hair on his legs, the way his skin always smells a little bit like the ocean, all beautiful and strange. Even crazier is that I let him look at me, too. First, I'll only let him pull my shirt aside and kiss my collarbone and shoulders. Then I let him draw my whole shirt over my head and lie me down in the bright sunshine and just stare at me. The first time I'm shaking. I keep having the urge to cross my hands over my chest to cover up my breasts to hide. I'm suddenly aware of how pale I look in the sunshine and how many moles I have spotting up and down my chest, and I just know he's looking at me thinking I'm wrong or deformed. But then he breathes, "Beautiful." And when his eyes meet mine, I know that he really, truly means it. That night, for the first time in my life, I stand in front of the bathroom mirror and don't see an in-between girl. For the first time, with my hair swept back and my nightgown slipping off one shoulder and my eyes glowing, I believe what Alex said. I am beautiful.
But it's not just me. Everything looks beautiful.
The Book of Shh says that deliria alters your perception, disables your ability to reason clearly, impairs you from making sound judgments.
But it does not tell you this, that love will turn the whole world into something greater than itself. Even the dump, shimmering in the heat, an enormous mound of scrap metal and melting plastic and stinking things, seems strange and miraculous, like some alien world transported to Earth. In the morning light, the seagulls perched on the roof of City Hall look like they've been coated in thick white paint. As they light up against the pale blue sky, I think I've never seen anything so sharp and clear and pretty in my life. Rainstorms are incredible, falling shards of glass, the air full of diamonds. The wind whispers Alex's name and the ocean repeats it. The swaying trees make me think of dancing. Everything I see and touch reminds me of him, and so everything I see and touch is perfect. The Book of Shh also doesn't mention the way that time will start to run away from you. Time jumps, it leaps, it pours away like water through fingers. Every time I come down to the kitchen and see that the calendar has flipped forward yet another day, I refuse to believe it. A sick feeling grows in my stomach, a leaden sensation that gets heavier every day. 33 days until the procedure. 32 days. 30 days. And in between, snapshots, moments, mere seconds. Alex smearing chocolate ice cream on my nose after I've complained I'm too hot. The heavy drone of bees circling above us in the garden. A neat line of ants marching quietly over the remains of our picnic. Alex's fingers in my hair. The curve of his elbow under my head. Alex whispering, "I wish you could stay with me." While another day bleeds out on the horizon, red and pink and gold, staring up at the sky, inventing shapes for the clouds. A turtle wearing a hat, a mole carrying a zucchini, a goldfish chasing a rabbit that is running for its life. Snapshots, moments, mere seconds. As fragile and beautiful and hopeless as a single butterfly flapping on against a gathering wind. Chapter 17. There has been significant debate in the scientific community about whether desire is a symptom of a system infected with amor deliria nervosa or a precondition of the disease itself. It is unanimously agreed, however, that love and desire enjoy a symbiotic relationship, meaning that one cannot exist without the other. Desire is enemy to contentment. Desire is illness, a feverish brain. Who can be considered healthy who wants? The very word want suggests a lack, an impoverishment. And that is what desire is, an impoverishment of the brain, a flaw, a mistake. Fortunately, that can now be corrected. From The Roots and Repercussions of Amor Deliria Nervosa on Cognitive Functioning, 4th edition, by Dr. Philip Berryman. August makes itself comfortable in Portland, breathes its hot and stinking breath over everything. The streets are unbearable during the day, the sun unrelenting, and people rush the parks and beaches desperate for shade or breeze. It gets harder to see Alex. East End Beach, normally unpopular, is packed most of the time, even in the evenings after I get off work. Twice I show up to meet him, and it's too dangerous for us to talk or make a sign to each other, except for the quick nod that might pass between two strangers. Instead, we lay out beach towels 15 feet apart on the sand. He slips on his headphones and I pretend to read. Whenever our eyes meet, my whole body lights up like he's lying right next to me, rubbing his hand on my back, and even though he keeps a straight face, I can tell by his eyes that he's smiling. Nothing has ever been so painful or delicious as being so close to him and being unable to do anything about it. Like eating ice cream so fast on a hot day, you get a splitting headache. I start to understand what Alex said about his aunt and uncle, about how they even missed the pain after their procedures. Somehow, the pain only makes it better, more intense, more worth it. Since the beaches are out, we stick to 37 Brooks. The garden is suffering from the heat. It hasn't rained in more than a week, and the sunlight filtering through the trees, which in July fell softly like the lightest footstep, now slices dagger-like through the canopy of trees, turning the grass brown.
Even the bees seem drunk in the heat, circling slowly, colliding, hitting up against the withering flowers before thudding to the ground, then starting dazedly back into the air. One afternoon, Alex and I are lying on the blanket. I'm on my back. The sky above me seems to break apart into shifting patterns of blue and green and white. Alex is lying on his stomach and seems nervous about something. He keeps lighting matches, watching them flare, and blowing them out only when they're almost at his fingertips. I think about what he told me that time in the shed. His anger about coming to Portland. The fact that he used to burn things. There's so much about him I don't know. So much past and history buried somewhere inside of him. He has had to learn to hide it, even more than most of us. Somewhere, I think, there is a center to him. It glows like a coal being slowly crushed into diamond, weighed down by layers and layers of surface. So much I haven't asked him, and so much we never talk about. Yet, in other ways, I feel like I do know him, and have always known him, without having to be told anything at all. It must be nice to be in the wild right now, I blurt out, just for something to say. Alex turns to look at me and I stammer quickly. I mean, it must be cooler there because of all the trees and shade.
It is.
He props himself up on one elbow. I close my eyes and see spots of color and light dancing behind my lids. For a second, Alex doesn't say anything, but I can feel him watching me.
We could go there, he says at last.
I think he must be joking, so I start to laugh. He stays quiet, though, and when I open my eyes, I see his face is totally composed. You're not serious, I say, but already a deep well of fear has opened inside of me, and I know that he is. Somehow I know, too, that this is why he's been acting strange all day. He misses the wilds.
We could go, if you want to.
He looks at me for a beat longer and then rolls onto his back.
We could go tomorrow, after your shift.
But how would we... I start to say. He cuts me off.
Leave that to me.
For a moment, his eyes look deeper and darker than I've ever seen them, like tunnels.
Do you want to?
It feels wrong to talk about it so casually, lying on the blanket, so I sit up. Crossing the border is a capital offense, punishable by death. And even though I know that Alex still does it sometimes, the enormity of the risk hasn't really hit me until now. There's no way, I say almost in a whisper. It's impossible. The fence and the guards and the guns.
I told you. Leave that to me.
He sits up too, reaches out and cups my face quickly, smiling.
Anything's possible, Lena,
he says, one of his favorite expressions. The fear recedes. I feel so safe with him. I can't believe that anything bad can happen when we're together.
A few hours, he says. Just to see.
I look away. I don't know. My throat feels parched. The words tear at my throat as they come out. Alex leans forward, gives me a quick kiss on the shoulder, and lies down again.
No big deal,
he says, throwing one arm over his eyes to shield them from the sun.
I just thought you might be curious, that's all.
I am curious, but...
Lena, it's fine if you don't want to go. Seriously, it was just an idea.
I nod. Even though my legs are sticky with sweat, I hug them to my chest. I feel incredibly relieved, but also disappointed. I have a sudden memory of the time Rachel dared me to do a back dive off the pier at Willard Beach and I stood trembling at its edge, too scared to jump. Eventually, she let me off the hook, bending down to whisper,
It's okay, Lena Lou. You're not ready.
All I'd wanted was to get away from the edge of the pier, but as we walked back onto the beach, I felt sick and ashamed. That's when I realize. I do want to go, I burst out. Alex removes his arm.
For real?
I nod, too afraid to say the words again. I'm worried if I open my mouth, I'll take it back. Alex sits up slowly. I thought he'd be more excited, but he doesn't smile. He just chews on the inside of his lip and looks away.
It means breaking curfew.
It means breaking a lot of rules. He looks at me then, and his face is so full of concern it makes something ache deep inside of me.
Listen, Lena.
He looks down and rearranges the pile of matches he has made, placing them neatly side by side.
Maybe it's not such a good idea. If we get caught, I mean, if you got caught. He sucks in a deep breath. I mean, if anything ever happened to you, I could never forgive myself. I trust you, I say, and mean it 150%. He still won't look at me. Yeah, but the penalty for crossing over? He takes another deep breath. The penalty for crossing over is, at the last second, he can't say death. Hey, I nudge him gently. It's an incredible thing how you can feel so taken care of by someone and yet feel also like you would die or do anything just for the chance to protect him back. I know the rules. I've been living here longer than you have. He cracks a smile then. He nudges me back.
Hardly.
Born and raised, you're a transplant. I nudge him again, a little harder, and he laughs and tries to catch hold of my arm. I squirm away, giggling, and he stretches out to tickle my stomach. Country bumpkin? I squeal as he grabs out and wrestles me back onto the blanket, laughing.
City slicker,
he says, rolling over on top of me and then kisses me. Everything dissolves, heat, explosions of color, floating. We agree to meet at Back Cove the next evening, a Wednesday, since I won't be working again until Saturday. It should be relatively easy to get Carol to allow me to sleep over at Hannah's. Alex walks me through some of the major points of the plan. Crossing over isn't impossible, but hardly anyone risks it. I guess the whole punishable by death thing isn't really a big attraction. I don't see how we'll ever make it past the electrified fence, but Alex explains that only certain portions of it are actually electrified. Pumping electricity through miles and miles of fence is too expensive, so relatively few stretches of the fence are actually online. The remainder of the fence is no more dangerous than the one that encircles the playground at Deering Oaks Park. But as long as everyone believes that the whole thing is juiced up with enough kilowattage to fry a person like an egg in a pan, the fence is serving its purpose just fine. Smoke and mirrors, all of it, Alex says, waving his hand vaguely. I assume he means Portland, the laws, maybe all of the USA. When he gets serious, a little crease forms between his eyebrows. A tiny comma, and it's the cutest thing I've ever seen. I try to stay focused. I still don't see how you know all this, I say. I mean, how did you guys figure it out? Did you just keep running people at the fence to see whether they got fried in certain places? Alex cracks a tiny smile.
Trade secrets. But I can tell you there were some observational experiments involving wild animals.
He raises his eyebrows.
Ever eaten fried beaver?
Ew!
Or fried skunk?
Now you're just trying to gross me out. There are more of us than you think. That's another one of Alex's favorite expressions, his constant refrain. Sympathizers everywhere, uncured and cured, positioned as regulators, police officers, government officials, scientists. That's how we'll get past the guard huts, he tells me. One of the most active sympathizers in Portland is matched with the guard who works the night shift at the northern tip of Tukey's Bridge, right where we'll be crossing. She and Alex have developed a sign. On nights he wants to cross over, he leaves a certain flyer in her mailbox. The stupid, photocopied kind that takeout delis and dry cleaners give out. This one advertises for a free eye exam with Dr. Swild, which seems pretty obvious to me, but Alex says that resistors and sympathizers live with so much stress, they need to be allowed their little private jokes. And whenever she finds it, she makes sure to put an extra large dose of Valium in the coffee she makes for her husband to drink during his shift.
Poor guy, Alex says, grinning. No matter how much coffee he drinks, he just can't seem to stay awake.
I can tell how much the resistance means to him, and how proud he is of the fact that it is there. Healthy, thriving, shooting its arms through Portland. I try to smile, but my cheeks feel stiff. It still blows my mind that everything I've been taught is so wrong. And it's still hard for me to think of the sympathizers and resistors as allies and not enemies. But sneaking over the border will make me one of them beyond a shadow of a doubt. At the same time, I can't seriously consider backing out now. I want to go. And if I'm honest with myself, I became a sympathizer a long time ago, when Alex asked me whether I wanted to meet him at Back Cove, and I said yes.
I seem to have only hazy memories of the girl I was before then. The girl who always did what she was told and never lied and counted the days until her procedure with feelings of excitement, not horror and dread. The girl who was afraid of everyone and everything. The girl who was afraid of herself. When I get home from the store the next day, I make a big point of asking Carol if I can borrow her cell phone. Then I text Hannah, "Sleep over tonight with A?" This has been our code recently whenever I need her to cover for me. We've told Carol we've been spending a lot of time with Allison Duvney, who recently graduated with us. The Duvneys are even richer than Hannah's family, and Allison is a stuck-up bitch. Hannah originally protested against using her as the mysterious A on the grounds that she didn't even like to think about pretend hanging out with her. But I convinced her in the end. Carol would never call the Duvneys to check up on me. She'd be too intimidated and probably embarrassed. My family is impure, tainted by Marcia's husband's defection and, of course, by my mother. And Mr. Duvney is the president and founder of the Portland chapter of the DFA, Deliria Free America. Allison Duvney could hardly stand to look at me when we were in school together. And way back in elementary school, after my mother died, she asked to switch desks to be farther away from me, telling the teacher that I smelled like something dying. Hannah's response comes almost immediately. "You got it. See you tonight." I wonder what Allison would think if she knew I'd been using her as cover for my boyfriend. She would freak out for sure, and the thought makes me smile. A little before 8 o'clock, I come downstairs with my overnight bag slung conspicuously over my shoulder. I've even let a little bit of my pajamas poke out. I've packed the whole bag exactly as I would have if I were really going to Hannah's. When Carol gives me a flitting smile and tells me to have a good time, I feel a brief pang of guilt. I lie so often and so easily now. But it's not enough to stop me. Once outside, I head toward the West End, just in case Jenny or Carol is watching from the windows. Only after I reach Spring Street do I double back toward Deering Avenue and head for 37 Brooks. The walk is long, and I make it to Deering Highlands just as the last of the light is swirling out of the sky. As always, the streets here are deserted. I push through the rusted metal gate that surrounds the property, slide aside the loose slats covering one ground floor window, and hoist myself into the house. The darkness surprises me, and for a moment I stand there, blinking, until my eyes adjust to the low light. The air feels sticky and stale, and the house smells like mildew. Various shapes begin to emerge, and I make my way into the living room and to the mold-spotted couch. Its springs are busted, and half of its stuffing has been torn out, probably by mice, but you can tell that once it must have been pretty. Elegant, even. I fish my clock out from my bag and set the alarm for 11:30. It's going to be a long night. Then I stretch out on the bumpy couch, balling my backpack underneath my head. It's not the world's most comfortable pillow, but it will do. I close my eyes and let the sounds of the mice scrabbling and the low groans and mysterious tickings of the walls lull me to sleep. I wake up in the darkness from a nightmare about my mother. I sit up straight, and for one panicked second don't know where I am. The faulty springs squeal underneath me, and then I remember, 37 Brooks. I fumble for my alarm clock and see that it's already 11:20. I know I should get up, but I still feel groggy from the heat and the dream. And for a few more moments, I just sit there, taking deep breaths. I'm sweating. The hair is sticking to the back of my neck. My dream was the one I usually have, but this time reversed. I was floating in the ocean, treading water, watching my mother perched on a crumbling ledge hundreds and hundreds of feet above me. So far, I couldn't make out any of her features, just the blurry lines of her silhouette framed against the sun. I was trying to call out a warning to her, trying to lift my arms and wave at her to go back, away from the edge. But the more I struggled, the more the water seemed to drag at me and hold me back, the consistency of glue suctioning my arms in place and oozing in my throat to freeze the words there. And all the time, sand was drifting around me like snow, and I knew at any second she would fall and smash her head on the jagged rocks, which poked up through the water like sharpened fingernails. Then she was falling, flailing, a black spot growing bigger and bigger against the blazing sun, and I was trying to scream, but I couldn't.
and as the figure grew larger, I realized it wasn't my mother headed for the rocks. It was Alex. That's when I woke up. I finally stand, slightly dizzy, trying to ignore a feeling of dread. I go slowly, gropingly, to the window and am relieved once I'm outside, even though I'm in more danger on the streets. But at least there's a bit of a breeze. The atmosphere in the house was stifling. Alex is already waiting for me when I arrive at Back Cove, crouching in the shadows cast by a group of trees that stand near the old parking lot. He is so perfectly concealed that I almost trip over him. He reaches up and draws me down into a crouch. In the moonlight, his eyes seem to glow, like a cat's. He gestures silently across Back Cove to the line of twinkling lights just before the border, the guard huts. From a distance, they look like a line of bright, white lanterns strung up for a nighttime picnic, cheerful almost. 20 feet beyond the security points is the actual fence, and beyond the fence, the wilds. They've never looked quite so strange to me as they do now, dancing and swaying in the wind. I'm glad Alex and I agreed not to speak until we crossed over. The lump in my throat is making it difficult to breathe, much less say anything. We'll be crossing over at the tip of Tukey's Bridge, on the northeast point of the cove. If we were swimming, a direct diagonal from our meetup point. Alex pumps my hand 3 times. That's our signal to move. I follow him as we skirt the perimeter of the cove, being careful to avoid the marshland. It looks deceptively like grass, especially in the dark, but you can get sucked down almost knee-deep before you realize the difference. Alex darts from shadow to shadow, moving noiselessly on the grass. In places, he seems to vanish completely before my eyes, to melt into darkness. As we loop around to the north side of the cove, the guard stations begin to outline themselves more clearly, becoming actual buildings, one-room huts made of concrete and bulletproof glass. Sweat pricks up on my palms, and the lump in my throat seems to quadruple in size until I feel like I'm being strangled. I suddenly see how stupid our plan is. 100, 1,000 things could go wrong. The guard in number 21 might not have had his coffee yet, or he might have had it, but not enough to knock him out, or the Valium might not have kicked in. And even if he is asleep, Alex could have been wrong about the parts of the fence that weren't electrified, or the city might have pumped on the power just for the night. I'm so scared I feel like I might faint. I want to get Alex's attention and scream that we have to turn around, call the whole thing off, but he's still moving swiftly up ahead of me, and screaming anything or making any noise at all will bring the guards down on us for sure. And guards make the regulators look like little kids playing cops and robbers. Regulators and raiders have nightsticks and dogs. Guards have rifles and tear gas. We finally reach the northern arm of the cove. Alex drops down behind one of the larger trees and waits for me to catch up. I go into a crouch next to him. This is my last opportunity to tell him I want to go back, but I can't speak. And when I try to shake my head no, nothing happens. I feel like I'm back in my dream, getting slurped into the dark, floundering like an insect stuck in a bowl of honey. Maybe Alex can tell how frightened I am. He leans forward and fumbles for a moment, trying to find my ear. His mouth bumps once on my neck and grazes my cheek lightly, which, despite my panic, makes me shiver with pleasure, and then skims my earlobe.
"It's gonna be okay,"
he whispers, and I feel slightly better. Nothing bad will happen when I'm with Alex. Then we're up again. We dart forward at intervals, sprinting silently from one tree to the next and then pausing while Alex listens and makes sure there's been no change, no shouts or sounds of approaching footsteps. The moments of exposure, of dashing from cover to cover, grow longer as the trees begin to thin out, and the whole time we're getting closer and closer to the line where the fringe of grass and growth disappears altogether, and we will have to move out in the open, completely vulnerable. It is a distance of only about 50 feet from the last bush to the fence, but as far as I'm concerned, it might as well be a lake of burning fire. Beyond the torn-up remains of a road that existed before Portland was enclosed is the fence itself, looming silver in the moonlight, like some enormous spider web. A place where things stick, get caught, are eaten. Alex has told me to take my time, to focus, when I pick my way over the barbed wire at the top.
but I can't help but picture myself impaled on all of those sharp, spiny barbs. And then, suddenly, we are out. Past the limited protection offered by the trees, moving quickly over the loose gravel and shale of the old road. Alex moves ahead of me, bent nearly double, and I stoop as low as I can, but it doesn't make me feel any less exposed. Fear screams, slams into me from all sides at once. I have never known anything like it. I'm not sure whether the wind picks up at that second or whether it's just the terror cutting through me, but my whole body feels like ice. The darkness seems to come alive on all sides of us, full of darting shadows and malicious looming shapes, ready to turn into a guard any second, and I picture the silence suddenly punctuated by screams, sighs, horns, bullets. I picture blooming pain and bright lights. The world seems to transform into a series of disconnected images. A bright white circle of light surrounding Guard Hut 21, which expands ever outward as though hungry and ready to swallow us. Inside, a guard slumped backward in his chair, mouth open, sleeping. Alex turning to me, smiling. Is it possible he's smiling? Stones dancing underneath my feet. Everything feels far away, as unreal and insubstantial as a shadow cast by a flame. Even I don't feel real. Can't feel myself breathing or moving, though I must be doing both. And then, just like that, we're at the fence. Alex springs into the air, and for a second he pauses there. I want to scream, "Stop! Stop!" I picture the crack and sizzle as his body connects with 50,000 volts of electricity. But then he lands on the fence, and the fence sways silently, dead and cold, just like he said. I should be climbing up after him, but I can't. Not immediately. A feeling of wonder creeps over me, slowly pushing out the fear. I've been terrified of the border fence since I was a baby. I've never gotten within 5 feet of the fence. We've been warned not to, had it drilled into us. They told us we would fry, told us it would make our hearts go haywire, kill us instantly. Now I reach out and lace my hand through the chain link, run my fingers over it. Dead and cold and harmless. The same kind of fence the city uses for playgrounds and schoolyards. In that second, it really hits me how deep and complex the lies are. How they run through Portland like sewers, backing up into everything, filling the city with stench. The whole city built and constructed within a perimeter of lies. Alex is a fast climber. He's made it halfway up the fence. He looks over his shoulder and sees that I'm still standing there like an idiot, not moving. He jerks his head at me like, "What are you doing?" I put my hand out to the fence again and then immediately jerk it back. A shock runs through me all at once, but it has nothing to do with the voltage that should be pumping there. Something has just occurred to me. They've lied about everything. About the fence and the existence of the invalids. About a million other things besides. They told us the raids were carried out for our own protection. They told us the regulators were only interested in keeping the peace. They told us that love was a disease. They told us it would kill us in the end. For the very first time, I realized that this, too, might be a lie. Alex rocks carefully back and forth on the fence so that it sways a little. I glance up and he gestures to me again. We're not safe. It's time to move. I reach up and hoist myself onto the fence and start climbing. Being on the fence is even worse in some ways than being out in the open on the gravel. At least there we had more control. We could have seen if a guard was patrolling, could have hurried back to the cove and hoped to lose him in the darkness and the trees. A small hope, but hope nonetheless. Here we have our backs turned to the guard huts, and I feel like I'm a gigantic moving target with a big sign on my back saying, "Shoot me." Alex reaches the top before me, and I watch him pick his way slowly, painstakingly around the loops of barbed wire. He makes it over and lowers himself carefully down the other side, climbing backward a few feet and pausing to wait for me. I follow his motions exactly. I'm shaking by this point from fear and exertion, but I manage to pass over the top of the fence, and then I'm climbing down the other side. My feet hit the ground. Alex takes my hand and pulls me quickly into the woods, away from the border, into the wilds. Chapter 18. Mary, bring out your umbrella.
The sun shines down on this fine, fine day, but the ashes raining down forever are going to turn your hair to gray. Mary, keep your oars a-steady, sail away on the rising flood, keep your candle at the ready, red tides can't be told from blood. Miss Mary, A Common Child's Clapping Game, dating from the time of the Blitz, from Patty Cake and Beyond, A History of Play. The lights from the guard hut get suctioned away all at once like they've been sealed back behind a vault. Trees close in around us, leaves and bushes press on me from all sides, brushing my face and shins and shoulders like thousands of dark hands, and from all around me a strange cacophony starts up of fluttering things and owls hooting and animals scrabbling in the underbrush. The air smells so thickly of flowers and life it feels textured like a curtain you could pull apart. It's pitch black. I can't even see Alex in front of me now, can just feel his hand and mine pulling. I think I might be even more frightened now than I was making the crossing, and I tug on Alex's hand, willing him to understand me and stop. A little farther, comes his voice from the darkness ahead of me. He tugs me on. We go slowly, though, and I hear twigs snapping and the rustle of tree branches, and I know that Alex is feeling his way, trying to clear a path for us. It seems that we move forward by inches, but it's amazing how quickly we've lost sight of the border and everything on the other side of it, as though they've never existed at all. Behind me is blackness. It's like being underground. Alex, I start to say. My voice comes out strange and strangled sounding. Stop, he says. Wait. He lets go of my hand, and I let out a little shriek without meaning to. Then his hands are fumbling on my arms, and his mouth bumps against my nose as he kisses me. It's okay, he says. He's speaking almost at a normal volume now, so I guess we're safe. I'm not going anywhere. I just have to find this damn flashlight, okay? Yeah, okay. I struggle to breathe normally, feeling stupid. I wonder if Alex regrets bringing me. I haven't exactly been Miss Courageous. As though he can read my mind, Alex gives me a second small peck, this time near the corner of my lips. I guess his eyes haven't adjusted to the dark either. You're doing great, he says. Then I hear him rustling in the branches all around us, muttering little curses under his breath, a monologue I don't quite follow. A minute later, he lets out a quick, excited yelp, and a second after that, a broad beam of light cuts upward, illuminating the densely packed trees and growth all around us. Found it, Alex says, grinning, showing off the flashlight to me. He directs the light down to a rusty toolbox half buried in the ground. We leave it there. For the crossers, he explains. Ready? I nod. I feel much better now that we can see where we're going. The branches above us form a canopy that reminds me of the vaulted ceiling of St. Paul's Cathedral, where I used to sit in Sunday school to hear lectures about atoms and probabilities and God's order. The leaves rustle and shake all around us, a constantly shifting pattern of greens and blacks, set dancing as countless unseen things hurry and skip from branch to branch. Every so often, Alex's flashlight is reflected for a brief second in a pair of bright, wide, blinking eyes, which watch us solemnly from within the mass of foliage before vanishing once again into the dark. It's incredible. I've never seen anything like it. All this life pushing everywhere, growing as though at every second it's expanding and thrusting upward, and I can't really explain it, but it makes me feel small and kind of silly, like I'm trespassing on